Welcome to the Legendarium.
Let's see. I don't know how to pronounce the name on this, but Tar Ankaliman or something like
Tar Ankaliman.
Tar Ankaliman. Ankaliman.
Yeah, you have to be a linguist to participate in this podcast.
Well, see you guys.
I'm not.
Bye.
Hey, welcome back to the Legendarium podcast, everybody. I am Craig Hanks. Over there is Ryan Bruckman, and over there is Nick Jeter. No insults for you guys today because we're kicking it old school.
What?
But rest assured, I hate you both. Yeah,
I had all kinds of mean retorts ready based on what you might say.
Did you just say retorts?
Retort.
You said retort.
Retort. I've been saying retort.
I don't think you can use that word anymore.
Yeah, exactly. All right.
Responses, and they all ended with "I hate you."
We are going old school. It's a Silmarillion episode today. We'll get there in just a moment. Before I do, want to encourage anybody who's listening to make sure you join in on our ongoing series this year. If you're listening to this, there's a good chance that you found us because you love the Silmarillion or Tolkien or whatever. We are this year reading mostly Brandon Sanderson stuff. If you know him, you probably love him. If you don't know him, then you should. And one way you can get to know him is to head to thelegendariumpodcast.com, click on the giant banner link there, and join our reading challenge for Brandon Sanderson. I would encourage you all to do that. We've got until the end of the year for you to complete that challenge and read a bunch of his books. They're amazing and wonderful, mostly. I think we've had one so far that we weren't so wild about, but that's about it.
Yeah, pretty much.
So, yeah, definitely do that. The other housekeeping item, support us on IMSI. Please head to IMSI.com/legendarium. Join this new community platform there, IMZY, IMSI.com/legendarium. You can join the community there that's still in beta. And if you join that community, then you can tip the Legendarium, and that's a way for you to support the podcast. We really appreciate everybody who's done so thus far. We thank you for your support, and we would love for the rest of you to kick in, you know, whether it's $1 or $5 or whatever you can or want to give to support this amazing intellectual journey that you take with us.
Just think, if you don't donate, we have to start doing product placement in the middle of our podcasts, in the middle of our thoughts.
What products would you
like? My thought, you know, we would be saying something, and I would be saying, "This thought by Ryan is brought to you by Coke Zero."
Oh, that would
something
be amazing.
Like that. And that's what it'll turn into. And
you
know
would
what?
Let Coke Zero sponsor you?
Sure. I would let anybody sponsor me at this point. Ashley Madison could sponsor me.
Todd would definitely love a Coke Zero sponsorship.
Oh, seriously.
I'm a Diet Coke guy. So,
speaking of which, Todd and Ken aren't here because we don't like them, but it is Ryan and Nick. So I say we're kicking it old school because we're going back to the days before Todd and Ken even joined us. Ryan and I, our first series of podcasts was on The Lord of the Rings, and Nick, you appeared on that
on one
episode. Yeah. Greatest
day of my life.
You need to do more.
I'm not married. I have no children, and I've never done anything. So
so many jokes on that. Okay, so anyway, we are doing our third episode of the Silmarillion today. This time we're talking about Akalabeth, the story of the downfall of Numenor. I'm very excited. This is maybe my favorite section in the Silmarillion. There's a couple others that make a good case. I love Beren and Lúthien. I love the story of Túrin, but Akalabeth, this is so good. And I hope you guys enjoyed it, and I hope you guys paid attention, because again, kicking it old school, we are bringing back a long lost segment. This is Craig's Lord of the Rings trivia. Today it's slightly different. It's Craig's Silmarillion
trivia,
I guess.
It all falls the same for me.
Meaning you lose?
Pretty much.
Yeah. Okay. I did try to I did try to keep it easy. There are approximately 85,000 names in the first three pages of this story, and I tried to leave most of those out of the quiz. We'll see how it goes. But, you know, a few of the names are important.
More consonants than a German phone book.
I pretty much consider the Silmarillion my words with friends cheat. You know,
nice.
It's the highest scores possible. I just find a word on a page and it'll work.
Oh, I used the Silmarillion for a stump the professor thing we did at the law school.
Oh, really?
And nobody got my trivia. It was what was the name the elves gave to themselves?
As in the Eldar?
No. Or maybe it wasn't the name. See, I already forgot my own trivia. It's not like the first page. They're called like the...
Maybe no one got it because you were wrong.
No, it's the Kindy or the Quindy.
Oh, the Quindy.
Was it the name they gave themselves or the names that...
Yeah, I don't know, dude. I have to go back and read it again.
Anyway, I knew it. No one else did.
I've read this book, I don't know how many times, 8, 10 times, and it's like every time I get to the end, my brain is like... Ah, now I can release all of that information and forget it until the next time I read it. Yeah,
so. In any case, if you're looking for no-holds-barred fantasy trivia, the Silmarillion is the place to go.
Well, wow, we are off track. So let's do a little Craig's Lord of the Rings trivia. 10 questions. I don't care who answers. You can shout it out. You can raise your hand. You can punch each other, whatever you feel like doing.
You kick his left shin, I'll kick his right shin.
Yeah, so we'll just both hit Craig.
Yep.
So, all right, here we go. Number one, fill in the blank. Akala Beth is the story of the downfall of...
Numenor.
Yeah, nice. Where is
Atalanta.
This... What? Nice. Where is this island situated?
In the ocean.
Be more specific.
Between the Undying Lands and Middle-earth.
Nice. Very nice. The Edain, or men, follow what famous star to get there?
Oh, crap.
Are you serious?
They follow a star?
The Star of Erendil.
Yes. Disney? Yes. Ryan's got it.
Disney Good. Movie?
Thank you, Lord of the Rings musical.
Exactly. Why were the Edain given this island? This is like page one stuff.
I thought it was because they were half elven.
Not quite. The Edain are men. So men versus elves. And these were the families or the not the race of men, that's not quite the right word for it, but these were the guys who had... You got it, Ryan?
Is it because of the what they did in the battle against Morgoth?
Yes, just yes. Basically that they helped.
Yes.
When men awoke in the east, Morgoth corrupted almost all of them, but like three families traveled to the west, met up with the elves in Beleriand, and eventually grew to these great nations and helped in the wars against Morgoth. So that's where this came from, basically. All right. Why? No, that's the one I just asked. The first king of Numenor is?
Something the tall?
I can't pronounce it.
Do you want me to give it to you?
No.
You got it.
I'm going to make...
Are you cheating? You're cheating.
We're not allowed to the book open?
That's fine, but this
we're
is a podcast.
We're encouraging people to read.
I don't want to listen to you flipping pages.
Oh, okay. It starts with an E and an A, and I can't...
No, it's Elros.
Oh, yeah.
Elros is the brother of... Just... Yeah, this isn't
Elrond.
A quiz question.
Elrond.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, Elrond and Elros are brothers. They're both half-elven. Elrond chooses to become an elf. Elros chooses to become a man, and he becomes the first king of the Numenorians.
So wait, Elrond was originally half and half, but he just became an elf all the way or something?
Well, no, he's still, at the time of the Hobbit and the Lord of the Rings, known as Elrond the Half-Elven, because he is half-elven. His mom was an elf.
I was going to say, did he have a race change or something?
surgery. It lengthened his ears a little
bit. Yeah, just a little bit.
Not quite.
He was Time's Person of the Year.
Yeah, there you go. So he, so Elros becomes a man, and one of the gifts, so the Edain are given a few gifts. One of them is Numenor, this new land that they can call their home, and the other is long life. And Elros lives to be 500 years old. Pretty awesome. Now, here's the last king of Numenor. What is his name? This is like half the story is about this guy.
Tal Palantir?
Not quite. That's his son, actually.
Oh.
So Tar Palantir is the father of Ar-Pharazôn.
Okay.
And Ar-Pharazôn is the last king of the Numenorians.
Right.
So
But Palantir, he's kind of what starts them on their wickedness?
We'll get there. Okay. We'll get there. Well, no, I mean, this is kind of a recap. That's the whole point of this quiz, right? So I guess I'll tell you now. Tar Palantir was, he was after a long line of pretty wicked kings.
Yeah.
And then he comes along, and his mother was actually one of the faithful.
Right.
And so she brings him up in the right ways. And then he tries to govern that way, but it's too late. Society's already too far gone. And so then when he dies, his not son, it's like his nephew or something like that, Ar-Pharazôn, becomes king and like takes everything to the nth degree and is awful and horrible. Okay. So Ar-Pharazôn is seduced by the dark side of the force. Who leads him down that path?
Sauron.
Yes. Sorry, I thought for some reason it had a different name in this one.
No, it was Sauron. Amandil is the leader of the faithful. We might recognize the names of his son and two grandsons. What are those names?
Elendil, Isildur, and I don't know what the other brother was.
That's the tough one.
The only one that I had was Isildur.
Yeah. So Elendil is his son. Isildur and Anarion are his grandsons.
Hmm.
Who eventually becomes, so Isildur is king of Gondor,
right.
And Anarion is king of the north, Arnor.
I was going to ask, what happened to him?
So, anyway, maybe we'll get there. Sauron and his followers construct a temple to Melkor in the middle of the city. It's 500 feet across, 500 feet tall, and its dome is made of what?
I'm going to assume marble. And the ceiling is covered with pictures of the creation by Michelangelo.
Nice. Nope, it is made of silver. Starts out silver, very quickly becomes black because of the sacrifices made in there and the smoke that comes from them. All right, question number 10. Ar-Pharazôn and his army sail for Valinor to steal immortality. It doesn't work because Ilúvatar destroys them all and does what to the world?
Makes it round.
Yes, correct. So, 10 questions. I think you guys both win some points because I wasn't keeping track. This is Craig's Lord of the Rings trivia, after all. We don't keep track of points.
We don't bother actually following that.
Absolutely not.
What was the utility of making the world round?
So, as is explained at the very end of this chapter, what happens is now men cannot seek out the Undying Lands. They are separated from the world. And so the Valar and their, blessed elves or whatever you want to call them, they are in this land of Valinor. Valinor is removed from the circles of the world. You can still get there if you you have your golden ticket.
If you have your access code.
So the elves, or not the elves, the men that went through all this, they surmise that there is still a straight path that they can no longer follow. So as they are sailing around the world, they're going around this curve, right?
Right.
But somewhere there is a straight path. And if you get on that path, it will take you to Valinor. So it's all very mythological.
So much geometry.
It's great.
You can sail to the moon.
Do you guys want a bonus?
Sure.
Yeah? All right. So this will be a tiebreaker for the tie that may or may not exist between the two of you. What was the first sacrifice made to Melkor in the Silver-Domed Temple?
A person?
You guys read this, right?
I did read it, but all I remember was being shocked by that they were doing it to people.
All right. No, the first sacrifice made was Nimloth, the White Tree. So there was a certain point at which, in fact, I think it was Tar Palantir who said, as long as the White Tree exists, or as long as it's cared for, then the line of kings will continue. And then not one generation has passed before the next king cuts it down. And then Sauron builds the temple and burns the tree.
Well, I had a question about that because Isildur saves a shoot from the tree and replants
a fruit,
and he replants it, and it becomes the White Tree of Gondor, if I understand right. And so Palantir's prophecy is holding true, or was he just saying if this tree is destroyed? I mean, because obviously his line didn't.
Right. Well, I'd say I'd leave that up to your interpretation. Seems plausible enough.
I'm going to say it worked.
Yeah, there you go. So, yeah, somebody survived. Because Elendil and Isildur and Anarion, they are kin of the king, right? So right. They're part of that line.
They're the rightful heirs of Numenor
in a way, when
it's gone.
Right. Yeah, there you go. Anyway, so good job, guys, at failing and not failing sometimes at Craig's Lord of the Rings trivia. Good job.
Yay!
So, Ryan, what did you think of Akala Beth?
You know what? I told you this when you first asked me about it. My first reading session was a little bit broken. It's what happens when you have a two-year-old around when you're trying to read.
Yeah, that's weird.
So the first time I went through, it just kind of washed over me. I didn't get a whole lot. But as I've been reviewing it again, like I really actually really enjoy this story a lot. Because I think mainly because of the scale of this story. It's a little bit larger than just two people. We're getting an entire race that we're following here. With the Numenoreans, and it gives me a little more insight into Aragorn and his predecessors and why some of the things that happened in The Lord of the Rings with him are important. They're not just little throwaways. For example, it's a dumb little thing, but the fact that I had the realization when Arwen talks about how they're going to have a child, the fact that it was kind of difficult, the Numenoreans didn't have many children, that actually is a big deal.
Right.
Like, I was like, oh, that's something that never occurred to me before.
Right. But there's some biological reason that it's a big deal that he's having kids.
Because they're tall.
Okay.
As a whole, I like this story, again, for its scale, for the fact that we're dealing with issues like what happens when men who have been given a lot by gods decide they want more. And what that means.
Yeah.
I liked that a lot.
Good, yeah, and I like what you said about it being better the second time through, because I think that's true of the Silmarillion at large. I've said this before, and I'll say it many times, that the second time through is much, much more valuable, because you have at least a little bit of a handle on what the story is. You know which names are going to be important and come up a lot, and which names you'll never have to remember.
Yeah.
So the second time is always better. And by the way, speaking of me repeating myself, I have probably said that on both of the previous Silmarillion podcasts. Yeah. But you have to understand, if you found these podcasts and you're just listening to all three in a row, it's been 10 months since our last Silmarillion episode.
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy. 10 months. We've been doing this podcast a long time.
You've been trying to spoon feed me the Silmarillion for a while now, so.
One day you'll have read the entire thing.
And not know it, and then you'll be like, now you just got to read it all front to, you know, cover to, exactly. Cover to cover.
It's just medicine he's putting in your dog food.
Pretty much.
So, Nick, what did you think of Akala Beth?
Obviously I liked it.
Obviously.
I don't have to like it.
Yeah.
I mean, did I appear to not like it? I thought I was obviously liking it.
Your emotional outbursts about it are, you know, fantastic.
Yeah. What I liked a lot was there was almost this sense of nostalgia in the way Tolkien wrote it, because he's writing about things that are happening before The Lord of the Rings. And like Ryan was saying, you have all these references to Numenor, and it's this lost paradise in a lot of ways. I felt kind of, nostalgia is probably the best word, just like, we get to look at what it was like. We get to look at who these people were in a glory that was lost. I noticed some interesting themes that show up elsewhere in The Lord of the Rings, or in this the Middle Earth, where men consistently think that they can take control, corral evil, and perhaps use it for their own purposes. And so we bring Sauron into Numenor. Isildur kept the ring, even though he knew. I mean, he took it with his eyes open. I mean, they took the Numenoreans took Sauron with their eyes open. They knew he was bad. Isildur knew the ring was bad, but he takes it. Denethor knows the Palantir is bad, but he uses it, and it always turns around.
Or maybe not bad, but beyond him at least.
Beyond him, right? Yeah, yeah. And that's probably a better way to talk about the ring too. Isildur knows it can be. He thinks it can be used for good. He knows it's probably beyond him, though.
Right.
I think that's an interesting theme that men. In fact, there's a line in A Calibeth where it talks about how men worship the darkness but fear it.
Oh man, was that the best line?
Yeah, you want to talk about a very metal CD cover. there's just so much profoundity.
I like it. Yeah, let's pretend to be smart.
Yeah, we're smart. I'll say it again. There's so much profundity in that statement.
I loved that because they were driven to the darkness by fear. It's fear of death
exactly.
That Sauron exploits and gets them to turn to the darkness. And so they're trying to overcome that fear in the way that, you know, Sauron is helping them do that. So they try to overcome it, but they never can.
Yeah.
So no matter what they do, you know, in trying to fight that fear, they succumb to it.
Yeah, and you look throughout world history and current events, we are afraid of so many things and justifiably afraid of many of them. And the effort to fight that fear or to fight against the things we're afraid of has often led to creating the very darkness we hoped we were fighting against.
Yeah. Well, that was cheerful. So,
I'm always a ray of sunshine.
I wanted to go back to the nostalgia thing. Ryan, was that you saying that? Is a very nostalgic thing, or
nope,
was that Nick?
That was Nick.
That was Nick.
Speaking of nostalgia, A Calibeth, do you guys know what that means? What the word came from? Because I don't think it's explained in the... Hey, was it explained in the text or did you look it up?
No, it was in... Because I need the helper guide as I'm reading this.
Nice.
It was something I was looking up.
She that hath fallen. So that's the name given to Numenor, to the island, after it's destroyed.
Wow.
So the name of the story... Yeah, it refers back to this place that's gone. I thought that was nice. Yeah. There are lots of little tidbits like that that you can get with the Google or with Craig's bookshelf if you have access to it.
This is one of the things I really... it actually sparked me pretty quickly on this. And this will be a chance for you to pontificate a bit if you want.
I hate doing that.
Yeah. I know we've discussed before the... Tolkien's desire to write a story that was for the history of his people of England.
Yeah. Right.
I'm curious as to how much of a role or influence that the Arthurian legends had on this piece, especially this piece. They referred, and I'm trying to remember exactly what it is, but Avalon, or I don't know how it's pronounced in
Avalone.
Here. Avalone. Which in the Arthurian legends, Avalon is
right.
Is an island where Excalibur is forged, where Arthur is taken to be healed. It's this magical paradise piece, and we've got a very similar piece here, that
in between place, where the gods and men mingle.
Yeah, I think you're definitely onto something. That's a big hole in my understanding of, you know, ancient myths and legends. I'm learning more about the Arthurian legends, but they haven't ever captured my imagination the way that a lot of things have. Until now, I'm learning some really interesting stuff, but I think you're onto something, and I think that it's not a mistake that Tolkien wants to create a mythology for England, and so he's going to borrow liberally or be inspired liberally by the things that they do have. I know he was very dissatisfied with the Arthurian legends, and especially how much they were just steeped in Christianity, because that shows that, you know, they weren't the proto-legends that he would have wanted to get to. They were kind of the stuff that came up after the Roman conquest, right?
Right.
And, so he was dissatisfied, but he definitely enjoyed using some of them.
I find that very interesting, because I really felt that this entire story of A Calibeth was a conglomeration of Arthurian legend and biblical stories. There's a lot of biblical elements that combine across.
Go on.
Just in terms of, for example, take the people wanting to get to the Holy Land where the gods were immortality was, you know, you have a Tower of Babel thing almost going where Eru Iluvatar has to come in and kind of stop them from doing this, you know, confounding the languages. There are so many things that had a really strong parallel to that, that my thought process was that this must have, like, this is heavily influenced by Christianity and
pieces. I think there's a difference. When I say steeped in Christianity, I guess what I mean is something a little more overt. And mm-hmm. so when you have Arthur and his knights going off on a quest, they go on a quest for the Holy Grail, which is a Christian relic. You know, so Christianity is really at the forefront of those legends. Whereas in this, his Christianity is certainly informing a lot of what he says and writes,
but it's not,
you know, they're not actually searching for Jesus's tomb or something like that.
Yeah, right. So Tolkien's Christianity plays a role in the story, but the Numenorean's religion is the Numenorean's religion.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. You know, pontification complete.
Yep. That's about as deep as I'm going to get.
You guys have some points you want to bring up? I've got five or six more.
My big one was honestly the, what I talked about with the men constantly thinking that they can control the evil.
Yeah.
And I, that might be just the end of the sentence or the whole, call it a whole paragraph if you want. I didn't like come to support this with like a big pontification, but I feel like it plays out in history and it definitely repeats itself throughout. It's a theme that you can look for throughout Tolkien's work.
I think in general you can see, I had a thought that's slightly, it's just enough different from that point about controlling evil. But the fact is these the Numenoreans, the Edain, this people were given an incredible gift for doing good or for being who they were. And in time, a little bit of corruption is what puts in their mind that you deserve more than what you've got. You should have more than that. You should be immortal. Yeah, you live a long time.
I think the word we use now is entitled.
Yes.
Well, and an important point that I realized, because I didn't realize that death was a gift or mortality was a gift to man.
Mm-hmm.
That you, I don't remember what the core, I mean, the elves get to live forever, but men get to die. And so they were given this as this mercy by the gods, and that gift is the very thing that they hate and they fight against.
That's one of my favorite themes of the entire Silmarillion, is the gift of death.
Mm-hmm.
It really puts an interesting spin on, you know, how on a daily basis we can think about death and life and all that stuff. Whereas the elves are tied up with the fate of the world, which has its own benefits. You know, it's very, I'm sure, fulfilling, on a certain level to be so intricately tied with the earth that you live on. But on the other hand, they're jealous of men because they will know at some point God in a way that the elves never will, because their assumption is that the men who die, and women, I mean,
they get
men with a capital M, they die and they go and live with Ilúvatar again.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, for the first time, I guess, if depending on which theology we're going with. Anyway.
Actually, that brings up a big question. What are the undying? Well, I didn't realize that the undying lands get separated from the world after. I didn't read this incredibly closely, and it was my first reading. But I was going to ask, are the Undying Lands heaven? I mean, it's a physical place that they can physically travel to.
I think the better word would be paradise.
And if they don't die, like, that's the end. But where do elves and men go when they die? Where do orcs go when they die?
So you participated in our Beren and Lúthien podcast, but you did not participate in the first one,
right,
where these things are kind of explained. So the Undying Lands, you have kind of like in Greek mythology, you have the god of blank,
right,
and one of them is the god of, I want to say the underworld, but he's actually a pretty decent chap.
Yeah,
you know, he's not Hades. Mm-hmm. And so when the elves die, they go back and live in the halls of Mandos.
Right.
This guy. And so they are still within the circles, the confines of the world, but they lack their physical body or the ability to go out and about in a certain way. Anyway. Well,
another question. Oh, wait, did you have one?
Okay. Oh, I was just going to say this is one of the reasons that I enjoy having you guys read the book this way is because, like I've mentioned on the other casts, it's so much fun for me to say or to see if somebody can just read a chapter out of this and get any or all of right. what's going on. That's a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
So a question that I had while I was reading is this the height of man's power?
Yeah, to this point, certainly.
Well, I guess we have to exclude if you're going to ask that question, we have to exclude the age of men.
Or yeah, we have to exclude now because remember right. this is like a proto history of
right. There's no the earth elves competing for men for domination.
There's, there
the
hasn't
ego.
Been a golden era of men before the right. Numenorean race.
Right.
Thing.
Yeah. So let's shift a little bit. I want to bring up some of the specific things that are mentioned in the book, some quotes. Did you guys have things you highlighted? Because I sure as heck did.
Yes.
One of my favorites, let's see, which one do I want? Oh, okay. Page 275 in... Oh, this was one of the fun parts when we said, hey, let's do a Silmarillion episode this week. And I said, okay, now the real question is, which copy of the Silmarillion do I read this out of?
I have a very old edition.
Yeah,
I'm wondering
you do.
If it's a 1977 thing that I got at a library sale when I was like 14.
That's 77 is when it was published. So it's a paperback, but you may have a first paperback
copyright
edition.
Copyright 1977.
Nice. Yeah, very cool. I'm holding the first American edition from Houghton Mifflin Company. I've got like three of these, and I've got one of the British one. I'm very excited about that one.
Oh, I'm
and
sorry.
I have the first edition of the Kindle publishing.
My printing is 1981.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that makes more sense.
Oh, well, the 81 copy was
yeah,
trash.
It was
no, okay, so I don't know where to situate it in the chapter, so I'll just read it. This is where Amandil, is, you know, who's the father of Elendil, he is saying things are getting really bad. The king is too influenced by Sauron. I'm going to do what Erendil did and sail to the Undying Lands and try to get the gods to intervene because we're in a lot of trouble. I know there's this ban, and I know that because of that, like I'm breaking certain rules, but I'm going to do it anyway because I feel like it needs to be done. I'll probably die. You'll probably never see me again, but it's got to be done. And Elendil says, would you then betray the king? And he says, the king and Sauron, everybody's been saying that we're traitors for a long time. And until you do this thing, that hasn't been true.
We're not traitors yet.
Yeah, we're actually, you know, we're supporting our people, the kingdom in our way, you know. But would you betray the king? And he says, Amandil says, I would betray the king. For there is but one loyalty from which no man can be absolved in heart for any cause. And I thought that was absolutely wonderful. You know, as far as things that, principles that could be applicable to you as the reader, to, you know, to leave the reading and take with you.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? So it, now Tolkien here is talking about loyalty to God, or in this case, Eru, right? But, and I think for many readers, it would boil down to the same thing. But even if you don't believe in God, I think you can still use this as a principle where you drill down to the most important things. So those things, they can and they should go beyond kings and presidents and flags and countries,
mm-hmm.
Down to, you know, more basic principles, freedom, law, property, whatever the principles are that, you know, that you think undergird all of what it means to be human.
Yeah, and it's a really interesting kind of a constant battle between loyalty to the law. I mean, so our entire society is built on law. We are protected by the laws. But there's kind of this...
But there's a principle underneath the law.
Right.
And what happens when the law is breaking the principle, so to speak.
Yeah, and the reality is we can make, or those in Washington or whatever government you're from, could make whatever law they want. And there's a point where the law can go beyond the principle, and there's this justifiable... I mean, the law even acknowledges it. Like, it's against the law to kill somebody, but... It's within the law to kill somebody in self-defense if you can justify the fact that they were trying to kill you. And so in some ways we've tried to make a kind of make an accounting of the fact that the principle is there, and sometimes the law needs to bend for that a little bit
for the principle.
But I mean, always go to the most extreme examples we know in history. The law in Germany in 1939 was pretty dang bad. And I would say that those that obeyed it were the criminals and not the ones that tried to fight against it.
Right. Because there's something deeper.
Right.
Yeah.
See, I think this is interesting, and I'm going to pull us into another realm a little bit, because recently a film came out. I don't want to date us too much, but they use a quote in Civil War.
Captain America?
Yeah, Captain America, Civil War.
That was a bad title. They should have just called it Civil War or Avengers 3.
The
Glory 2, starring Steve Rogers.
The quote is, "The nation was founded on one principle above all else, the requirement that we stand up for what we believe, no matter the odds or the consequences. When the mob and the press and the whole world tell you to move, your job is to plant yourself like a tree beside the river of truth and tell the whole world, no, you move." And
You did not read that nearly epically enough.
I wasn't really aiming to
for epic
on that.
I love that quote. That's a great quote.
That's in
Civil War.
Yeah.
Well, I know he uses part of that in the movie.
It's his new love interest, the whatever.
Right. But doesn't he say that in the comic somewhere?
Yes. If you read the actual comics, was it him or was... Yeah, it's him. I think he's talking to Tony at that moment or something. And he says that there. And it's similar to that principle of what you're talking about there. My question is with that is, I think a lot of people have taken that concept and applied it to things that don't necessarily, that aren't those firm fundamental things.
Right. Yeah. And that's the problem with, you know, we have this, you can fight against bad laws, but if you just assume that a bad law is everything that doesn't comply perfectly with what you want and desire, then this principle cannot be too individualistic. In fact, I think the only way it can function when applied is altruistically. Like, I will do this thing to help other people, which also breaks down because terrorists use that exact...
the same principle.
So maybe it doesn't break down, but the principle holds, but its application can be very, very... corrupted.
Yeah, and that's I think it's one of the marks of
a good principle
of a good a good principle or something from literature that is worth thinking about, where, you know, the three of us can sit in a room and talk about this thing, but are we going to have any answers on what the perfect fundamental principles are? You know, not necessarily. We're going to have our opinions on what those things are, and other people are going to have their opinions. But I think one of the more rewarding experiences of life, at least mine so far, is taking the time and sparing the mental energy to decide what your fundamental principles are. You know, Nick and I, before we turned on the microphones, we were talking about... oh gosh, it just fled my mind what the principle was we were talking about.
That if there's no checks and balances.
I'd say it was something else.
We were talking about politics.
It's a little more political than it is fundamental, but dang it.
No. How important if a leader.
It doesn't matter. It's gone. It's out of my mind.
Well, here's one of the reasons why I think that this concept in this story is so important is identifying that fundamental, that baseline here. Also helps us when people decide to vary and move away from it. So you have this group, the Numenoreans here, and as they are they bring Sauron in and they're corrupted, they kind of lose who they are, what their fundamentals are, because they start to believe that what they are and what they have been is not enough. And I think that happens frequently with our, at least within our current culture, that we decide that what is fundamental has to grow and has to be different. It has to be better than it was before. And that's not always necessarily the case. A fundamental is a fundamental from the start. And so in this story, we have them saying, Sauron telling him that, you know, like a great king takes what is rightfully his. Well, right. And in this case, it's the immortality and everything that the Valar have.
Yeah.
Well, that's him just saying, your fundamentals are wrong. You should be more than you are.
Yeah.
And when you lose sight of that baseline is how you end up feeling like you need more than what you have been given.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Man, I could go on this subject for a long time, I bet.
Mm-hmm.
Fundamental principles. The thing I was thinking of, or no, a thing I was thinking of, we weren't talking about this, but I was thinking about this when I was reading this text, was a fundamental principle you might think, don't kill. Like, killing is bad.
Right.
But I would say, no, that's not the fundamental principle.
Yeah, that's the
rule. You have to go deeper than that. And deeper than that, you would say maybe something like, life is precious.
Right.
That's your principle.
Life is sacred. Life is precious.
Because like you mentioned earlier, sometimes, you know, you don't have a choice and killing is the right thing to do.
Yeah, killing in and of itself is not an absolute bad.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's why I'm going to kill you guys. Maybe we should talk about something else now.
How about art?
That would be bad.
It's a really short thing. That's not a ton to it here, but I found it very interesting that he took the time in the story as he's talking about the Numenoreans, that they could have easily outclassed anybody in Middle Earth in warfare, weapons, in everything. They became quite the craftsmen. They became the pinnacle of what
civilization
meant. They were stronger than Sauron.
Yeah.
I mean, it took three movies to kill him in Lord of the Rings, and they just showed up, and he was like, oh, crud. Like,
never mind.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I found it very interesting. He has a specific line in here that he talks about that. He says, they could have easily surpassed the evil kings of Middle Earth in the making of war and the forging of weapons, but they were become men of peace. Above all arts, they nourished shipbuildings and sea craft. And just before that, he had talked about how they became, for the Dunedain became mighty in crafts, and so they had in mind they could easily have surpassed the evil. That's what it was.
Yeah.
I just thought it was, I don't know if that was a little commentary there of the value of arts and those things in helping people achieve the pinnacle of who they can be. As an artist myself, I always look for little quivers like that when people devalue the arts and things like that. I think it rounds out people as a whole and it gives you a chance to look at something and instead of just choosing warfare, there's other methods.
I absolutely agree. And I think it's very, very telling that he went in the same breath as mentioning art, he mentions shipbuilding.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that interesting? Like, it's not, he's not necessarily talking about, you know, like galleries and plays and
paintings,
stuff, though
I'm
sure that that's included in what he's thinking of, but
creation.
Creation.
Art and creation is a very similar, they tend to run almost synonymous in a lot of things.
And if you were going to become a great shipbuilding society, you know what you're going to have to learn? A whole friggin' lot of math.
And mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hey, you're going to have to learn astronomy. You know, you have to learn material science, you know, as far as mm-hmm. the materials used for things like that. So, yeah, art, I think, as a concept is, I think you put it better as creation.
Yeah.
Right. And I think you introduce a very interesting point in that progress, and let's call it a capital P progress, where we can assume that we're talking about just everything is going forward toward what? Like,
right.
This is good. This is technology. This is life is improving. It is never bifurcated or like we're progressing. You don't progress by only focusing on one thing.
What?
Keep
explaining.
Sorry. Okay. So, I mean, the Soviets, they focused on industrial progress. But art, I mean, they had like propaganda. I mean, they focused on war and technology, and they ended up not being very good at the technology part. Their art, their culture, their religion, even the family broke down in Soviet society. What Ryan introduced was this idea that if you're going to progress, you're going to progress totally. Look through history, the greatest societies we've ever seen, including the United, including Western European United States. Even the Romans, you're looking at people that progress on every level. They're going to progress in the arts. They're going to be strong militarily. but it's all a manifestation of what is actually strength, not just we're strength.
So progress must be holistic.
Sorry that took so long. Progress is holistic.
And I think part of the reason that that is the case is because one and the other are a set of checks and balances to each other. If you have nothing but, like, because you talked about with the ship, if you just as an artist built a ship, there's a good chance if you don't know the math and everything, you're going to get lost at sea even if it floats.
Right.
You know, you have to know those things. Certain things can progress better, easier with that. They don't necessarily need each other as much, but one will put a check and balance on the other as to asking that great question posed by Jeff Goldblum in Jurassic Park, should you do it?
Yeah.
The artistic exploration and creation that we look at, a lot of times we'll explore that, should we do this? And then the other side says, how do we do this? And
science,
we balance each other
science
out.
Science is all about how, and morality is all about why or should.
Mm-hmm.
Very nice. Good. I think, Nick, do you have bullet points or should I move on to one of mine?
Nope.
I've got a fun one.
Okay.
The movie version of this. I'm not going to ask you guys to cast it or anything, but were there any parts of this? I was tempted as I was reading this to be like, oh, this is unfilmable because it's too big. It's too broad. We don't really have any main characters, but I came up with one. My main character is Elendil. And I think that this could make a really cool, if dark and depressing movie.
Yeah, if the movie starts, I mean, you don't need a whole movie to say this is a great society. I mean, that's an introductory thing. Bring back Kate Blanchett and have her
narrate
the beginning where it's like the Numenoreans were awesome. And
Krypton from Man of Steel.
There you go.
That first 20 minutes of the film was like incredible.
Yeah, give it some development. Show what's gone wrong with the Numenoreans, but try to show what was right before it was wrong.
There was one specific scene.
I love when the little prof, the I'll call her a prophet, the messenger from Manwe shows up.
Mm-hmm.
That's my scene. I love that spot.
Nice. Yeah, that's a good one. My scene is when Elendil refused. That's right. So he refused the summons of the king when he set forth to war. And so the king is going to go sail to the Undying Lands. He's got 1,000 ships. And apparently, this is the only line we're given. Apparently, he calls for Elendil and his house and all these faithful to come with him. And he refuses that summons of the king. And then it says, and avoided the soldiers of Sauron that came to seize him and drag him to the fires of the temple. And that's the whole line. And then the story just goes on from there. And they escape.
Avoid means a lot of things.
But that is such an evocative line of the book where that's a great scene from a movie. Mm-hmm. You could build an entire story around this guy who has to avoid the king's guards.
Or Isildur, that scene where he steals the fruit from Timbrel, the tree. What do they call it?
The name of the tree, Nimloth?
Nimloth. I don't know why I put a T in there. No, that scene of him sneaking in to steal a piece of fruit, but this fruit is, for real reasons, very powerful and
precious.
Yeah. And then he's got to sneak through guards, he's got to fight. Like,
if you kept it inside that family, I think that you could tell a great story. Like, you'd have to kind of run their story simultaneously through the whole pit. My only issue that I have with the concept of turning this into a film is that we have a very large, please say I'm using this right, Deus Ex Machina.
Okay,
at the very
you said it right, at least.
Where basically, to stop the bad guys, God smashes them with rocks.
Yeah, that's true.
There's the payoff on that doesn't feel like a very...
I totally agree. Yeah. That might not come across all that well in film, but maybe that's not your climactic scene. Maybe your climax comes sooner.
Yeah. Right, and things get destroyed. I mean, the fact that the island is destroyed and that the bad guys are destroyed, that, from Isildur and Elendil's perspective, they're just living this experience. They're not thinking, well, God destroyed them, or maybe they are, but it's an event that happened independent of what's going on in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, you can depict an island being sunk into the ocean And later you can say, God did this. But for that family, it's just, we're escaping, we're refugees to Middle Earth. And so I think there's a story there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, in the hands of a skilled writer, I suppose. That's not me.
In fact, I think the best way to tell that story would be, you can still have like the messenger from Manwe show up, or Manwa, how do you say it?
Manwe, yeah.
Manwe show up and say, hey, even if you made it to she gives her message where don't go to the Undying Lands, you're not going to be undying even if you make it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we know that God is involved, or at least people that believe in God are involved as someone in the audience,
right,
if you're watching this film. And then just let everything God does be a part of the scenery. Events happen. And to people, it's not like they're watching the hand of the Iluvatar.
Right.
They're just watching. It just so happened that their land was destroyed. And places get destroyed all the time.
You know, speaking of hand of God, messing with the end of a movie, Ryan, Raiders of the Lost Ark, it sure worked there.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Indy lost. So the story was only saved by this incredibly crazy, horrific event happening at the end of the movie, saving the day, right?
Oh, okay. Yeah, sorry. I'm in Last Crusade in my head. I'm like, what are you talking about?
Oh, I was thinking Last Crusade. Yeah, Raiders of the Lost Ark.
That's a straight-up Deus Ex Machina, and it works.
I'm going to melt your face and kill all the Nazis and no one else.
For those who follow The Big Bang Theory, there's an entire episode about that where Amy points out to Sheldon that Indiana Jones he has no value in the movie because the Nazis, if he wasn't there, still would have found it. They still would have opened it, and they still would have burned his face, like their faces off.
And yet, the movie is awesome.
But yet, it's still incredible.
Yeah,
yeah.
Okay, so bad guys. Let's talk about bad guys. I think it might have been you, Nick. It might have been Todd during the Baron and Luthien episode who talked about how much fun it was to see a different side of Sauron.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And how much more do we get of him here? I love Sauron. He's called Sauron the Deceiver. And I think he's called that from, you know, long before this story.
Well, I think they used the word fair, or he was no longer...
Yeah, we'll get there at the end of the story.
I'm trying to imagine what he would have looked like pre ghostly goblin.
Well, so I think if we're going with visualization, you'd have to go, he looked pretty much like an elf, or you know. And by the way, elves in Tolkien's Middle Earth don't have pointy ears or anything like that.
Really?
Yeah.
So no, the movie
they're
just
very beautiful people.
Yeah, they're just like a more elegant type of.
So the movie gave them pointy ears just for
differentiation. Yeah, so that when we're watching, it's like, oh yeah, that dude's an elf. He's got pointy ears. You know.
I am offended.
Is it the long blonde hair didn't give it away in the first
right.
place?
Right.
Like. But yeah, he. So there are. Well, there's at least one union of elf and Maya with Thingol and Melian. They're, in fact, right behind you in that painting on the wall. And they get married. She's actually of the same race as Sauron, and he marries her nonetheless.
Well, what race is Sauron?
He is a Maya.
Isn't Gandalf a Maya?
Yes.
Yeah. Right, so...
Not to say that they are
humanoid messengers
demigod
from the Lord.
Type.
Right,
from
demigod.
God.
Demigod. Go with demigod.
Demigods.
think Greek.
Okay.
So anyway.
So Percy Jackson.
Yeah. Check. So Sauron. I guess I just wanted to mention him. He is one clever son of a bitch, if I may say so. He's a little too clever, it turns out, at the end. But I just love that about him. He's, if you read this and you get this picture of Sauron in your head, then when you're reading The Lord of the Rings, suddenly there's a little more behind this kind of incorporeal bad guy who we never meet. And there's a reason why he's so feared. It's because he is that clever. He's that good.
That's the difference. One thing I think that is a little bit of a disservice to average fans, just average fans of Lord of the Rings, is
the lack of Sauron.
The fact is that Sauron, in to the average person who's either just seen the films or maybe has only read the original, the trilogy, he seems almost more like a warlord than he is
than a demigod.
Because you think of you like when I first started reading this, when I was first thinking about it after having seen the films and everything, Sauron is this armored guy, you know, armored creature with it's incredibly powerful. But the fact of the matter is almost kind of his last resort. Fine, I'll put on the armor and I'll go do it myself type deal. Whereas his greatest power is his deception and his subtlety and his that great aspect of him, which is why what makes truly terrifying villains are the ones not who can kill you, but the ones who can make you kill or destroy yourself.
Right.
And that's what he does.
The Joker is like the best bad guy ever for that reason. Right?
Yeah. Which, killing joke, so excited. yeah. And that's, I think in this story, getting a chance to see him not as this incredibly powerful warlord creature wreaking havoc upon the bodies of men and elf alike. You see him as this man who turns from prisoner into the advisor and turns an entire kingdom into a different direction simply by suggestion, because it's not magic. It's knowing people and knowing how to turn them, you know, to play on that insecurity just enough to turn their direction a little bit.
And boy, does it work, and boy, is it awesome. In fact, it works so freaking well. I love it. He has this plan to turn his enemies, so his enemies are the Valar and the Numenoreans, and he just plays them off each other so brilliantly. Mm-hmm.
But he's short-sighted.
Yeah, right.
I mean, he's planning hundreds of years, and actually, I don't know what the timeline is when they show up and capture him, and then he stays in Numenor for a long time. He misses the forest for the trees. He wasn't exactly hoping. I mean, his body gets destroyed when Numenor collapses. I don't think that was on his to-do list.
That was an awesome image, by the way. Him sitting on his throne in the temple laughing as it like falls into the chasm. Top.
Yeah, he's a psycho. that's a setback in a way for him. I don't think he expected to die, however you want to, whatever happens to Sauron. And so his spirit endures, but he misses something here. He's so focused on his goal that he doesn't see what could happen.
Yeah. You could say that, or he has just, I don't know that he necessarily planned to lose his physical form, but he's realized that the physical form is a very small aspect
of
who he is and his power. And it's, if he's going to lose something, that's probably the part that you can get away with losing the most and still wreak the havoc and rule the way that you want to, because, you know, you can be a flaming giant eye on the top of a tower.
I thought you were going to say a flying nun for a second. You'd be whatever you want.
No. That is an interesting concept, just the value of his physical form. And because I think he probably would have made a bigger deal about...
Yeah, so not so much short-sighted, just I'm focusing on my priorities.
This isn't going to derail my plan. It's a little inconvenient, but this isn't going to derail anything that I've done.
It was certainly not part of his plan. He was not expecting to lose his body. Mm-hmm. Sauron's actually a shapeshifter, which power he no longer has when he loses his body. So
I guess that's true.
So he does lose some power.
Yeah. He loses that at least. But anyway, we're coming up on an hour already, so we better wrap it up. Do you guys have any final thoughts on, what the story meant to you and whether you'd recommend it to other people?
I'd recommend it to other people. I mean, maybe not every single person I meet.
Right.
But it's like, hey, if you want to read this kind of story and if you presume to say that you like the fantasy genre, you really kind of have to. It was a sad story because, again, back to that nostalgia, you have this glory of days past corrupted, and then he describes the women and children and just the people that they've already been suffering under a bunch of bad kings, human sacrifices, etc., and then they all get destroyed very uncomfortably.
Yeah, sad story. Agreed. Check mark on that one.
I think I'm pretty sure this is a point that we've iterated on our previous Silmarillion episodes. I think that this story is fantastic and deserves to be told. And I mean literally actually told.
Spoken.
Spoken. This is a story that I feel would actually do really well. And since you brought up making a film, I would actually say if they're going to do Silmarillion, don't do the Silmarillion film. It's a series, and you break down the stories the way that we're doing here, and you tell this one as, you know, a Netflix 3-4 episode piece, you know, Beren and Luthien's one, but it all falls under the title of Silmarillion. Because these stories, it evokes so much the campfire, telling them across, you know, the storyteller telling everyone surrounding him this incredible legend, this incredible story. That's what the power of these that we've read so far has, and this one is probably the best out of all of them to fit that feeling. And I really would love to sit and have someone very skilled tell me this story.
Yeah, I agree with that a lot. And I would say if you are going to read this, or if you're going to suggest this to somebody, I think, like you say, Nick, be selective. You know, this isn't the story to suggest to everybody. It's not going to tickle everyone's fancy, but if you think that somebody would enjoy it, give them two books. I'm holding in my hands, one, The Silmarillion, and two, The Tolkien's World from A to Z, Complete Guide to Middle-Earth. There are a few of these floating around. They're basically Tolkien dictionaries or glossaries, and it was immensely helpful, because no matter how familiar you think you are with this story, you're going to forget little details and names, and it was a lot of fun for me to, you know, flip between the two books and, wait, what was the name of that tree? Oh, yeah, that's right, Nimloth.
I have a book called The Tolkien Bestiary.
Oh, yeah, I think it's behind you in that cabinet somewhere.
It is awesome.
It's a lot of fun.
And a lot of really cool illustrations for people that like pictures.
My final thought would be, if you like pictures, Nick, and
I do,
you should go to kiprasmussen.com. Kip Rasmussen, you may remember from our first episode of The Legendarium, or sorry, the Silmarillion episode. He's a Tolkien illustrator. Specifically, he does mostly stuff out of the Silmarillion, and it's really good. The painting that I pointed you toward behind you, that's a Kip Rasmussen. I love his stuff. You know, some of it is better than others, but I think he's very skilled and has a way of evoking certain things out of the stories that other artists don't quite grasp. I think he's great and would love for our listeners to support him. If you enjoy art, click over to his website. Yes, you can buy prints and have them sent to you. They're wonderful, and I recommend it. KipRasmussen.com, if I'm not mistaken, or you can just Google him. It's pretty great.
If you Google search Kip Rasmussen Tolkien, I'm guaranteed you'll find him.
Yeah. So good. Thanks for coming on, you guys, and reading the story. Ryan, I think we're down to like, you know, a half dozen more Silmarillion episodes, and you'll have done the whole thing.
Uh-huh.
And I will gloat. And then you'll make me do Eye of the World, or what, Wheel of Time and then you'll gloat.
The unfortunate thing is that piecemealing that one will take us a lot longer.
Isn't that weird?
Read these chapters out of Path of Daggers, and when you wake up, please.
All right, guys. Thanks for listening. Head to thelegendariumpodcast.com. Join the Brandon Sanderson Reading Challenge. Go to imzy.com/legendarium and support the podcast there by tipping the community. And we will see you all when we reconvene in a week or two for the next Brandon Sanderson podcast, which is Elantris, which I am seriously looking forward to. And of course, we'll do more of these Silmarillion episodes as well. So stay tuned for that, and we will talk to you guys later.